Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. I hope you're well and acclimating to winter. We're coming into the darkest part of the year, and in 3 weeks, we'll be easing back toward the light. Glad to hear from so many of you this past week. The conversation I had with A Chance to Grow seemed to have some impact. While the focus of the conversation was more on childhood development, I think just about everybody can look back at their childhoods to points where they struggled and probably didn't get resourced very well. And I like to think that it's getting better, but change in awareness and understanding comes slow. I have an email to share that I received this week from Drew in Dallas, Texas. It says, "Hey, Jeremy, thanks for continuing to do this podcast. I got turned on to your podcast a few months ago. A lot of what your guests talk about really seems to really resonates with me. Also, I lived in New York for 8 years, so I love to hear New Yorkers on the podcast. And I've been to Minneapolis a few times for work. It's a really cool city. I've been meaning to write you to tell you how much I enjoy these conversations for a while. This past week's episode really hit me hard. I have a child who was born with developmental challenges, and she's doing much better at this point. She's 10 years old now. It's been a really tough stretch for our family. My wife and I actually didn't make it through the early years, but are really good friends now. We have both learned a lot about ourselves and about life in general through the process. Your conversation with Bob really gives a glimpse into what it's like to be a parent of a child with developmental challenges. We eventually did find some amazing therapists who have become like family to us. This episode did an amazing job of telling the story of people like us and offered a lot of insight into the process and the kinds of resources available. I also appreciate the consideration Bob talked about with parents. That guy knows, I'm sure. All my best to you, Jeremy, and happy holidays, Drew." Thanks for sharing this, Drew. Not sure if I've mentioned this in any of the episodes. I may have, but my daughter, Iris, was diagnosed with bacterial meningitis at 12 days of age, and we spent a month in the hospital administering antibiotics, and we had some touch-and-go moments, but she's 7.5 years old now, and happy, creative, athletic little girl with a wicked sense of humor, and, you know, but we did have some scary moments in there, and then, you know, for the next 3 years or so, we still had concerns as well that she might have some delays. So having gone through that, I felt like this might be a good topic for the podcast, and I'm glad that many of you felt the same way. I'm always looking for guests who I believe are having an impact on their community. If you know someone that you think I should have a conversation with on the podcast, please email me at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. And if you're looking to give people the gift of better health, consider a monthly donation to this podcast. I started this podcast in part because I wanted more people to be better informed about how to build health into their lives. And for $5 to $10 a month, whatever you feel like, you can help this podcast continue to grow and resource more people. We are now bringing quality resource to listeners in more than 25 countries. It only takes a minute. You can go to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. And you can see me in front of the camera explaining our mission somewhat awkwardly. I promise it'll be worth your while. My guest on the show today is another one of those people making an impact on her community. If you haven't noticed yet, I'm trying to make a case for a community having a much bigger impact on health than we give it credit for. We all need access to health care, but when it comes to our day-to-day livelihood, it's the environment that we're in, and by this I mean not only earth, air, and water, but the places in which we spend our time that might be of an even greater importance to our sense of well-being. Restaurants are places that we go not just for nourishment, but to relax, chill out, meet with our family and friends, and even sometimes the staff become extensions of our family. Sohee Kim is a chef and entrepreneur. She and her business partner and husband, Ben Schneider, have created with their restaurants an atmosphere that encourages family and friends to come together. Her food is inspired by her story. Emigrating with her family from Korea to the Bronx, cooking at Blue Hill in the city and Anissa in the village in New York, she finally settled into Red Hook, Brooklyn with her family. Inclusivity is a theme in both Sohee's menu and in the vibe their restaurants have created. I met Sohee about over 10 years ago. We were both starting our businesses in Brooklyn within a couple months of each other, and we immediately hit it off. And maybe because we were born just a day apart in the same year, not sure. But this is one of the many conversations that I've had with her over the years that somehow seem to keep circling back around to something we both have passions for: food, family, community, and health. She's one of the sweetest, most thoughtful, and funny humans I know. We start out here talking about my recent experience at her restaurant, Insa, in Brooklyn. Please enjoy my conversation with Sohee Kim.
There's one entrance to the main dining room, and that is via the long corridor. So you went there first.
Yeah.
You went through there.
Yeah.
And then you looked at the dining room, and then you went to your left.
Yeah.
And went into the dining space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we were looking at that space to possibly lease, just one big sort of rectangular squarish room. And when I walked in, I said, oh my gosh, this is so big.
Yeah.
It's almost too big, Ben. And he's like, no way. And then we sort of mapped out. But it's sort of still close to what we originally planned.
Yeah.
And I think it's smart to have that, you know, the left side of the space to be sort of a separate enclosed bar area.
Yeah.
That not just serves the dining room and also the karaoke rooms.
Okay.
But it's its own thing.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's running.
It's really cozy feeling in there, too. It's like a totally different.
It is. And I said to Ben, I was like, this is your play area in terms of design.
Yeah.
It's enclosed and you could do your magic.
I kind of felt like there was a little bend with that room, too.
Oh, not just a little. There's a lot. And then, of course, the main dining room, you know, with the 18 barbecue grills, I wanted it very communal, at the same time sort of sleek without being annoying.
Yeah.
Just clean. And, you know, you notice there's no tchotchkes. You know, it's just clean wood, curved wood walls.
Yeah.
Beautiful, you know, lighting on the walls. And in terms of a Korean restaurant, it has a really cool vibe because my gripe with Korean barbecue places is like too bright.
Yeah.
And it's like a little too jank. And you just kind of forgive it because you're there for the food.
Right, right.
Same with the
Russian restaurants, like, you know, that we go to. Even, I don't know if you've been to any of those places. There's like one in Queens. There's some down like further into Brooklyn that aren't the like Coney Island ones. They're just like the more neighborhoody versions of the Russian ones. But they all have exactly what you're talking about. Sometimes they're just like a little ostentatious.
It's
just,
yeah, you know, just either that or it's a little lackluster.
And or that,
always the lighting is not good. You right. know, you want to feel like you look good when you're eating to other people. And lighting is key. And not just that, but to people's moods as well when they're dining. So I think Ben hit it just right. Yeah. With the design.
Yeah.
And of course the karaoke rooms, I'm sad that you didn't get to see them.
I know.
Because it really does take you know, like a third of the restaurant space in the back.
Okay.
Five separate karaoke rooms, five rooms. And one that could accommodate up to 25 people in one room. And the other ones are smaller.
Yeah.
They're like 8 to 10 max. But it really is sort of a 3-in-1 operation, you know, the bar, the dining room, and the karaoke. And then you saw the open kitchen to the right.
Yep.
So 4,600 square feet, and every square feet is being utilized. And Ben was right. We don't have enough space for everything.
Wow.
So, you know, it's the numbers game in terms of square footage and how it all gets utilized is key. To how a restaurant operates. Because you're talking about the flow, you're talking about, you know, need, and it's you have to be absolutely organized, no matter what you do, right? But especially in a restaurant.
What's the max of that place, of Insa?
In terms of capacity?
Capacity, yeah.
I would say, well, there's 85 seats in the dining room. You could squeeze a few more in with additional chairs, but 85 is what we sort of cap it at. And then in the bar, it's about 40. And in the karaoke rooms, if you do the numbers, it's potentially 40, 65. So.
And so you, I'm guessing on weekends, sometimes you're at max.
Just to let you know, there's five people cooking on the line. The line is sort of the hotline, the cold line. And then there's always a chef on in charge that's expediting. So that's six-person line to service all three areas of the restaurant. And we could do upwards of 450 covers, which means that we could serve 450 dinners, possibly, wow, on a Saturday night. That never happens Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Right. But it does ramp up to the weekend. And I think the concept of Korean barbecue really lends itself to let your hair down and just let loose on a Friday, Saturday. So it is a weekend place for sure.
And you have that thing that you had out yesterday was the server offered to me, which I had no idea about, was this hot for the bibimbap, was this hot bowl. And she was trying to explain it to me. She's like, do you want a hot bowl? Keep the rice crispy and hot and all this stuff. And I was like, yes.
And it comes sizzling and
it's comes
super
sizzling
hot.
And it's hot. And in a way I sort of ended up taking my time a little bit with it.
Yeah.
So I sort of picked at it and I had these other things that came out ahead of it.
Right.
And are you supposed to mix those into the bowl too?
You can. And so this is a sort of the education of, Korean cuisine. You can if you want to. Some people do.
It felt right because they were kind of cooler.
Yeah.
And then we could kind of mix it in.
So you mixed everything together.
I mean, I was sort of nibbling at that stuff before my food came, but my food came so fast that I just was like, I'm gonna try all these things. And then once it came, I was like, oh, the seaweed would be good in here.
That's right.
Throw that in there. And then those soybeans or something?
They are soybeans.
Sesame seeds?
Yeah, soybeans that stewed in soy, basically.
Yeah.
And so that gives it a little bit like a salty umami sort of flavor. Yeah. So the whole idea of the offering of the side dishes, very simple. The offering of side dishes is very traditional. They call it side dishes, but it really isn't. It is sort of hey, this is what we do at this restaurant. So it's free, quote unquote, and it's offered to you. You should eat it with the meal that you're about to get, but it still is also sort of a sampler, like a tasting menu, if you will, from a chef.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody judges a good Korean restaurant by the quality of the kimchi and these other sort of morsels that you tried last night.
Yeah.
So it's like a positive, good face forward and say, okay, this is what you have to look forward to. And it's also an instance of the potential of educating diners into what Korean cuisine is.
Yeah.
And if you ask me, can you put it all together with the bibimbap? I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
There's no, with Korean dining, there's really no rule. You know what I mean? Because it is so much about communal dining, usually.
Yeah.
And it's about different flavor profiles sort of all at once. We are busy people. And historically, we're like, okay, chop, chop. Let's, get the dinner on the table and let's just eat and go do about our business. So there is no waiting, but it does, because of that, it does lend itself to absolutely a fabulous dinner out with a big group of friends so that you can try. Even when you order a la carte off the menu, you want to share everything. It does drive me crazy when 10 people come and they all order bibimbap. I'm like, really?
it's a lot of hot bowls.
It's a lot of hot bowls.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, man, I just thinking about the cleaning of all these things and the storage of all these and it's so cool too to look at.
Right, right. It is. And Korean people think that rice should be piping hot and soup should be bubbling hot, and that's how it's brought to you. Yeah. But in terms of maintenance, it's quite a bit.
So how did you get into cooking? Was your family did you have a role in the cooking process in your house?
My role was eating.
Yeah.
First and foremost. But I do, this new cookbook that I have out called Korean Home Cooking. I do talk about sort of the genesis, of my role or who I have become, which is a professional chef. But when I was younger, I have to tell you, I was an extreme picky eater.
Yeah.
I did have tasks and chores to do, and some of that had to do with, preparation of food. Like, for instance, you know, like the snack packs that you give to your children, if you have any, the seaweed that's roasted, and it feels like you're buying whatever, $2 for 6 pieces of seaweed that's roasted, but it's all air.
So papery.
That's right. And that was my job. So before you roast it, it's just basically sheets of nori, seaweed. And then my job was to, you know, dip like a brush into sesame, a blend of sesame oil and whatever other neutral oil. And I would brush.
It's pretty delicate work,
isn't
it?
Very delicate work. Yeah, perfect for like a 7-year-old, right? And then I would brush the seaweed and then lightly salt it. And then I would give it to my grandmother and she would just quickly roast it in a dry pan or sometimes over live fire.
Yeah.
And I would have to stack every roasted piece of seaweed, line it all up, and then cut it up into squares and put it in an airtight storage container that would maybe last about a week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I had chores like that. And, of course, dumplings is a fun, you know, process for little children to participate. So yes, I participated, and they gave me little fun things to do that way. But in terms of...
But being a kid, you didn't love it.
No. Like, I couldn't care less about the kimchi making process. And I was like, why is everything garlicky and so stinky? And, you know, that was my bratty little person attitude about the whole thing at the time.
Yeah.
You know, in hindsight, it would have been really wonderful. My grandmother's passed away now, and I feel like I learned a lot from her in terms of, not so much in terms of cooking. I think that I owe to my mother, who had the real sort of, you know, talent gene of you know, producing beautiful, amazing food. But my grandmother so much, you know, much so in the way of frugality and how she was a Buddhist, an avid Buddhist, and she had lived through two, you know, catastrophic, you know, wars.
Oh, yeah.
And so in terms of what to preserve, what to save, how not to waste, you know, definitely goes along the lines of her religion of Buddhism. Waste not, want not.
Yeah.
So it was amazing just in my memory to sort of glimpse at the thought of her, you know, pickling things and cleaning things and not wasting anything. If she planted some sweet potatoes, it wasn't just about the sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
That, you know, the meat of the plant, basically. It was about the vine. It was about the leaves. You know, how she composted nothing. She like really saved, dried, and found ways. And I think that people of that generation who did have to suffer through, you know, some heavy starvation mode.
Yeah.
It was fascinating to see her. So I wish I could, I wish I could have taken more notes actually looking back.
I know.
But yeah, and our family definitely, is a family that celebrates together. And, you know, there's just, and I think that, you know, it's not even just Korean culture. I think in general, you know, food is so much about the center of family or relationships, and it's just a focal point. And I've known that even though I wasn't necessarily, you know, interested in cooking, but it was something that was, you know, it's impactful, you know, where if you don't have nice things to say to each other as family, you know, at least you could share a meal, and talk about the food. So it's a connector. And I think that that's how I slowly fell in love with not just food and the art of cooking, but also, you know, the business of restaurants. What does it really all mean? What are we really trying to provide? And I think in the beginning, as a young cook chef, in opening the Good Fork with Ben, my husband, was really sort of nostalgic and kind of naive. Like, hey, I know how to cook. Hey, you know how to build. Why don't we open a restaurant?
Yeah, I was wondering why you guys ended up deciding to do that.
And I think it was this, you know, Ben had been working as a cabinet maker, and he also had aspirations of wanting to be an actor. And he loved the theater.
He's clearly a creative. I mean, just
very creative. Like, so I think, when I met him, I was finishing up culinary school and I was working at all these, you know, fancy fine dining restaurants.
Yeah, where did you work?
I worked at Blue Hill.
Oh yeah.
In Greenwich Village. And then I worked also at Savoy, which is no longer around for, Peter Hoffman and Anissa. which is also now no more, run by, you know, she's my mentor and a good friend that I could say right now. Her name is Anita Lowe, and she had Anissa for about 17 years. But it really sort of started with Blue Hill because it was my first foray into this, you know, exquisite world of fine dining. And the first time that Ben and I went there, when I was actually, I was working as an intern at the time, and Ben's mind was blown, and, you know, it just seems so, especially for Ben as my partner, he saw it as such, it was like theater. It is theater, you know, two businesses where the show, no matter what hits the fan, the show must go on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's on stage and also in restaurants.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So I think that he got why I was so, you know, enamored with it. And obviously, his parents have, you know, they're amazing, phenomenal cooks. So he was raised always eating good food.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in this fine dining sort of like, you know, premium restaurant sort of, you know, world that I sort of opened his eyes to.
The TV thing hadn't really exploded yet with TV cooking shows and...
No, not yet. But it was close. Like, I think in the early 2000s, you know, all of that stuff, like Top Chef and Food Network sort of exploded.
Yeah.
So there was growing sort of public interest. And I think for us as two creative people to come together and you know, it wasn't like I went to culinary school and I said, okay, let's open a restaurant. I did sort of work for these amazing chefs and sort of learned, you know, and sort of wrote down a list of to-dos and, you know, not to-dos, like what to do and what not to do in terms of service, business, food, all that stuff. So I'd taken like minor notes, but we were definitely not ready. Looking back, hindsight always being 2020, like what the heck were we talking about, you know, opening a restaurant. But I think that it was that naivete, feel the passion for us. And honestly, if we had known more than what we knew at the time, we would not have done it because the risk is too high, sacrifice is too much, the hours are long, and the money is never guaranteed. But thank goodness we were, I say, stupid enough to open the first one like 13 years ago. Because, you know, our lives are so shaped by what happened, you know, in March of 2006, which is the opening, you know.
And it's funny because that we started businesses, like we opened doors January 2006.
That's right. And when I met you towards the end of that year, maybe the year after that, I was like, I get it. I get what you were doing, you know, what you and your partners were doing there.
Yeah.
And it's this, you know, it's this whole sort of sense of creating community.
Yeah.
And places where people go to be nourished or welcomed or, you know what I mean? Like there's common ground. I saw that with you and your business. You a little bit more in terms of healing and nurturing, but you know, restaurants could be nurturing as well.
But it's food. And at the time, though, in Red Hook, there wasn't really anything like a restaurant, you know, like that was like that. That sort of had like a vibe and had like a very specific menu. Like the thing about the Good Fork that I liked was that somehow your like Korean cooking influence was in there, but you also had this like French culinary part and like a little bit of like Ben's Northwoods vibe or something.
Totally. I mean, you know, people were sort of confused, and I have to tell you, before we opened the doors, you know, we had some critics, you know, some family members and some people who are in the business are like, dudes, you gotta like focus and think of a concept that is like easy for people to digest.
Yeah.
So are you a Korean fusion restaurant or are you a seasonal, you know, bistro? Are you an Italian focused, you know?
Yeah.
And back then labels existed and they still do. But I feel like we were very headstrong in saying, you know what, we're not going to put ourselves necessarily in a category because this is obviously a passion project where we really might not know what we're doing, but we feel very strongly that this is how people should eat. And the menu that I designed for the, you know, the opening menu was very globe trotting, right? Yeah. And that is a word that exists today.
Yeah.
And that is a word, that is a phrase that has been developing for the past 10, 15 years. And I think the Good Fork had something to do with that, especially this big movement of, you know, talented young chefs coming to Brooklyn and opening up their own thing and not saying, it's not about the corporate, it's not about the fine dining, big food groups, you know, that are just operating in Manhattan. So around that time, people got it. Yeah, Red Hook isn't totally accessible and easy to get to know, but it's where we lived and it's where we thought there should be a restaurant like this, where it's small, it's run by, you know, a well-meaning couple. You know, there's a term for that, an old mom and pop shop.
Right.
And I felt like, and I still feel like these businesses are very few and far between, and it's really hard for us to exist, right?
Yeah.
But it was what was necessary. So I stuck to my guns and I said, it'll just be a menu that if people don't get, they don't get. But why can't you start off with a delicious, you know, plate of dumplings? Yes, that's Asian. And then finish off with like pasta with wild boar ragu that's made in house. Like, yes, that's kind of like confusing, but it is now the way people eat. We're totally open to that, but I'm not going to lie to you and say there was no pushback. Some people didn't get it.
But it's food as art to some extent. Like you're sort of expressing something through the food, and you're creating an environment, and the food is part of the environment. And
that's right. And when I get asked these questions a lot, and even back then, and I would say it's the kind of food that we want to eat personally.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about catering to a certain demographic or people. Like if we stay true to how we want to eat and how we want to be nourished and how we want to be treated at a restaurant, then, you know, we're doing something good.
Yeah.
Because at least, even if we don't do it correctly, at least it's earnest and it's honest.
Yeah.
And I think that that was the magic of the Good Fork that people really got. So even though it was in this this neighborhood where Red Hook Brooklyn is a destination spot, and so the Good Fork became one as well. But you never go through Red Hook Brooklyn to get anywhere. You have to want to specifically be there. So in opening this restaurant, I knew that there was a need for sort of a local neighborhoody joint for the neighbors of Red Hook. But I think I knew deep down that if we worked hard enough and the food was good enough, that people would travel to it and that it would become a destination place. And it did. And so it still is. And once the reviews came in, you know, it's always sort of nice to have your intentions affirmed, you know, with good reviews, and people get what you're doing. So
did the Good Fork cookbook draw any more restaurant people or, you know, foodies to it from other places? Because I imagine people come to New York and are just looking for something very specific to go check out.
So when we opened in March of 2006, you know, we opened to great reviews, New York Times, lots of local magazines like Time Out, New York Magazine, New Yorker Magazine. I mean, we really rode the wave
of
sort of new Brooklyn cuisine, they called it. So what that brought was attention. And one of the attention was national, like few of them actually. So I did this show called Throwdown with Bobby Flay, where he challenged me on the dumplings, and it aired like 2 years after we opened, and then it kept airing. So from the time 2006 when we opened to 2016 when I published the Good Fork cookbook, that's 10-year span, which is a long time for a small restaurant to survive. So we sort of survived on those, like, attention, whether it's local or national. The food and the Food Network shows brought in, you know, national people. So if they were coming in to vacation in New York City, like, oh, let's go to that dumpling lady's place. And I was like, cool, badge of honor.
And it's a cool out-of-the-way, kind of quieter. It's not the, you know, Manhattan scene, or even now, like Smith Street or whatever. Right.
So what the Good Fork cookbook did was, that was my intention, sort of document. Okay, so even if we say close tomorrow or something, then we would have documentation that this great place existed, and on all the recipes will be recorded. But at the same time, it was a tool to get people's attention again. Hey, you guys, remember the Good Fork that opened 10 years ago? Guess what? We're still here. We survived a major hurricane. several steps backwards, but here we are. So it became this great narrative, this great story to share with people that was outside of our family and friend circle, outside of the Red Hook circle, that restaurants like this have an amazing stories to tell, and hear the stories and hear the recipes. So to answer your question, yeah, people did notice again, and they said, oh yeah, that place, you know, because I think the noise and there's so many restaurants in New York City that it, you know, you could go to one restaurant, newly open restaurant for like, I mean, months on end, you can't, will never exhaust yourself.
And some of them have a marketing budget and everyone knows about them. And places like yours, it's like really hard to do.
So that was strategic, but it really, in terms of, you know, coming out with the book at the 10 year anniversary mark, it was strategic on my part, but at the same time was driven by this notion of like, oh, we could just perish tomorrow, you know?
Well, I mean, after Hurricane Sandy, I mean, I talked to you afterwards and I knew a little bit about what was going on, but did you have any idea that like when the storm was coming that anything like that could happen? Did you guys, you live like a couple blocks away, right?
So we live one block away. And Red Hook, you know, the geography of Red Hook is very interesting in that, like I said, we discussed, you don't go through Red Hook. If you go through Red Hook, you'll end up in the ocean, end up in the harbor. The topography and being so close to the water, it's flood zone.
Yeah.
And so even before the big hurricane, whenever there was like a torrential downpour or something, like there were pockets of floods.
Oh, is that right?
Here and there.
Did you have any in the restaurant?
It's a wet, you know, it's a wet terrain basically. So when it rains super hard, we would get a little bit of situation. So we have sump pumps going, and it's great that, you know, my partner Ben is a whiz at these things, and he'll just hook it up to avoid problems. But yeah, so I knew that about Red Hook. But in terms of, can you ever imagine yourself, you know, being a victim of a really bad hurricane? And honestly, I feel like in the past decade and a half almost now, since we opened and Sandy hit, I think 2012. And since then, in the past couple of years, we've seen some major, terrible, terrible hurricanes that like put Sandy to shame. You know what I mean? Like it's just colossal, and it's getting bigger and bigger. And of course, that's tied to the sort of the bigger overall global problem of climate change and all of that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we didn't expect it was going to be that big.
And it was like a 12-foot storm surge, right?
It was a 13-foot storm surge. Oh, and pretty much the main strip of Van Brunt Street, which is the main drag, and that's where the Good Fork is. And we got pounded, and so it was a rebuild. And a lot of businesses folded, or they survived, but it was tough.
And you're like storage of wine and all
gone. Yeah, all gone. So it was it cost us a lot of money to rebuild. But thank goodness for community.
Yeah.
A friend of mine told me there was this thing called GoFundMe, which now everybody knows about, but I'd never heard of it. And it sort of launched right around that time and said, listen, people really want to help you. Let them help you. And I was like, well, that's sort of a handout. I don't want to do that. But then, you know, 2 days after, it's still doom and gloom, and we're still trying to clean everything out, and everything's looking very bleak. I'm opening up mail and I start seeing checks, people like writing notes. Awesome, like very powerful, like I got engaged at your restaurant, here's $50 to, you know, put towards rebuilding, hang in there. And I was like totally close to tears, and it makes me sort of weepy just thinking about it. But so my friend said, you have to do it. It's not for you. Like this, now this restaurant belongs to, you know, more people. It is a property of the community and property of people that have come here, shared memories. And so it is not just you and Ben's show anymore. Yeah. So that was a very interesting lesson in sort of dealing, right?
Yeah.
It is our problem, obviously, that we have to either rebuild or walk away, but people have a say in it because this is now part of the greater community that is outside of us and our family. So a campaign was launched and we raised $50,000, which was our goal. just to replace, you know, the wines and the inventory that was lost. In, I think, 3 weeks, people gave $50,000 to this little fund so that we could, you know, it helped. Yeah. Is that the only money that we needed? No, but there were grants that we applied for, and then we then applied for a big loan. So we pieced it together. But I'm not going to lie to you, it was tough, but again, you know, you always make lemonade with lemons, and this was an opportunity for us not to sort of, not just to fix up sort of the infrastructure of the Good Fork, but also in our understanding of what the Good Fork means.
You now understood the community around everything.
That's right.
In a way where you were probably just like,
that's right,
in the business head, trying to like stay afloat all the time,
totally,
so to speak. But totally. You know, but all of a sudden you realize that, you know, what your place means to the people in your neighborhood and the even broader community. I know people. I heard at the time that people were like coming to Brooklyn from different places in the U.S. and you know, figuring out ways to give money to like local businesses and stuff. It's
totally
crazy.
I know. And that's, you know, when things like this happen, you do understand the generosity and the greatness of humanity, yeah, and how we are able to come together and help each other through rough times. But yeah, it was a very powerful lesson for me. Because I got into the business, I was like, hey, you know, this cocky cook, like, I could do this. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to cook my food and totally show off and be great. And, but the lesson that we learned just in the past 13 years, you know, how to be responsible business owners, you know, how do you treat your, how do we take the problems innate in the industry and make it better? Not, you know, if not to like spread the gospel of like being on a, you know, a soapbox or and say this is how you do it, but just to affect change within our organization, within our family, our restaurant. And we have done that. So it really, you know, having children, I think, is another big lesson for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But owning and operating a business that you're passionate about, the lessons are just limitless.
I felt that way, like having a business before having children.
Oh yeah.
I feel like I was prepared so well for so many different dynamics of just family life, and you know, the fact that, you know, your role and your opinion matters only as much as the greater whole of things.
Totally. And because, you know, both of us, Ben and I, come from two very distinct family histories, but close family units.
Yeah.
We really embrace this idea that the Good Fork family, the employees and people who make it possible, like, we love that. This is another family that, you know, we could support and be a part of. And Ben and I, he's an extrovert, I'm an introvert, but we're two very social creatures, and we love to be a part of things, and we like to think outside of the box. And when the Good Fork opened, it attracted people sort of like us, you know, slightly younger, artist types who got what we were trying to do. And so then this great community developed. But the thing about Sandy, and when you go through a disaster like that, it does put everything in perspective, so that we're not just like this island just floating around just by ourselves. And we do affect change, you know, in the community. And if we were to completely perish, then it would just not only affect us and our family, but the community at large. Yeah. And that's what I didn't understand before Sandy.
And you and I have talked about this, but it's like these places that in our communities that we go to are extensions of our homes. Like, I mean, and especially in a place like New York where you don't have very much home space,
right?
You go there, it's almost like your place to relax and let down, and for someone to recognize you for who you are. And the food is like a part of that. It's like this whole, you know, it's a big thing that doesn't get that much acknowledgement.
No, it doesn't. It's that Cheers effect, right? That sitcom in the 80s, right? Yeah. Norm goes, everybody, hey guys. And it is. I thought that just sort of, you know, lived in television or this sort of fantasy thing, but it is true. It is so much about the greater scenario. So, and I think Red Hook, is very specific neighborhood, mm-hmm. Because you can't get through to Red Hook to get to anywhere. You have to want to be there, like I said. So it creates a community of people who just want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially in a large city like New York, you go to different neighborhoods and places because the rent is cheap, or, you know, you have a friend living there. It's not as specifically like, okay, I just want to live in that neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's so now, but back then, it was interesting to meet the fellow neighbors and the reasons why. They all wanted to sort of leave the city behind without mm-hmm. leaving it.
Yeah, yeah.
And because the feel of Red Hook is so different from anywhere, and I vouch for that because I've lived in so many different neighborhoods, different boroughs.
But you will choose a neighborhood sometimes based on your local conveniences, and I think restaurants
sure.
are actually one of those things. I
totally.
Mean, we chose our place in Minneapolis now.
Right.
Based on that. And actually, if I think about it, I came to, in 99, I came to this area and
wow.
Smith Street had like three restaurants. I think
right.
Tabak was there already.
Right.
There was a Thai restaurant that's no longer there.
Yeah.
Uncle Pho.
Uncle Pho, I remember. I remember that.
And one other, like something else. Maybe, I mean, there's an old Italian restaurant that had been there for a long time.
There was Patois. The grocery,
yeah.
which was recognized.
But that was later, even.
It was a little bit later.
But that attracted me. Like, there was something about knowing that I had within a few blocks of where I lived that I could
right.
just, you know, walk down there. And that didn't exist quite as much in Minneapolis at the time, or any of these mid-sized cities in the U.S. just didn't have the walkable, you know, place to go. And I think that's now becoming a much bigger draw of where people want to sort of position
sure,
themselves.
Sure. So when you know, the real estate companies locally, they reach out to you, it's like, hey, could we get a photo? And we want to promote your restaurant. And that's sort of the carrot that they dangle. And I was like, wow, we're the carrot that they dangled so that they could
What do they give you for that?
Nothing. But but it's nice to be thought of that way, that somehow
yeah,
the
yeah.
Good Fork or even Insa and Gowanus, you know, could be a draw for people to want to be in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, that's cool. But we had the reverse approach, though. Like, let's find this neighborhood. Yes, it doesn't have any real restaurants or conveniences. Nothing that we really need
yeah.
exists here. But can we be sort of a pioneering spirit, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I found that most of and I'm not saying that, you know, Ben and I moving there, you know, what, like 19 years ago, that we were the pioneers. Not at all. Red Hook has such a unique history of sort of being shunned by the rest of the city, and having gone through so many troubles economically.
Yeah.
People were abandoning houses left and right because it became a liability, mm-hmm. and there were fires,
yeah.
and then TV shows sort of made fun of, like, if you see old like Law and Order episodes,
yeah.
you know, Briscoe and Green, they find dead bodies floating right by right in Red Hook.
Red
ding
Hook,
ding,
yeah,
Red
yeah.
Hook. You know, and the story begins.
Yeah.
And today it's a very different community, but when we moved there, it still had that sort of quality.
Yeah.
But there were people there way before us, and my next door neighbor, she raised 8 of her children there. She's now in her 80s, and I mean, the place just historically is just magical, you
yeah.
know, and its role in the Revolutionary War, and
yeah.
and just so much.
All those buildings down there are just incredible.
They're gorgeous. It was a very hopping port, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What is that movie with Marlon Brando?
On the Waterfront?
On the Waterfront,
yeah.
was supposedly about Red
about
Hook.
About that area, yeah.
And longshoreman bars, that's what Sonny's was. So there's still these little vignettes of stories that exist.
Yeah.
And romantic, you know, dodo heads like me and Ben are like, let's move there and open a restaurant.
Yeah.
And that, to me, it was selfish for us. But it was sort of meant to be. Like,
yeah.
we wanted to be a part of this kooky community and affect some sort of change, whether we knew it or not. But it's this idea of, like, doing something that maybe no one else is doing that interested us.
Yeah.
And the Good Fork, honestly, if it was in a different part of Brooklyn or some other city, the history of it obviously would be completely different. Like, we would be having a different conversation.
Yeah.
But it became what it became because of where it is. It sort of defined the Good Fork. Red Hook does.
Can you talk at all about your next venture?
I can. So timeline-wise, we opened the Good Fork in 2006. We had a couple of kids. And then we didn't open our sophomore project called INSA, which is a Korean barbecue place, until 2015. The book came out.
It's been 3 years already?
It's been 3 years already.
God.
And the cookbook came out in 2016. And the sort of the follow-up book, not related totally to The Good Fork, is Korean Home Cooking, which just came out last month.
Was that kind of inspired by stuff that you had
inspired,
to with INSA?
Totally inspired by everything to do with INSA and my sort of soul searching, I think, personally.
Speaking of soul, didn't you guys go to Kuril last
summer? We did.
How long had it been since you were there?
18 years.
Oh,
I hadn't been there in 18 years. So I was there in my late 20s, just sort of backpacking and trying to get to know. And that was before I started cooking. Right before, actually, I gave myself a little bit of time to sort of find out if that's indeed what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So it'd been 18 years, and like I said, 18 years filled with lots of fun events.
And you brought the kids with you?
And we brought our kids their first time and Ben's first time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And it was his biggest joke. He's like, I have two Korean biracial children. I own a Korean restaurant. I've never been to Korea. This is a shame.
Yeah.
So we changed that last year. And also, that trip also informed in the cookbook as well. I did obviously a lot of research when I was there.
I figured, yeah.
But it really started with our designs for INSA and me coming up with a menu for this traditional Korean barbecue place. But I wanted to do so much more than just barbecue.
Yeah.
So a lot of the recipes that are in the cookbook, you know, we serve at INSA, but a lot of it is focused on my memories of, you know, food that I ate that my grandmother made and my mother made back in Korea.
And you came to the States when? You were...
Well, I was 10.
10, okay.
So in my memory, it's like before, you know, like Korea was sort of like a dreamlike state.
Yeah.
Was I really there for 10 years,
yeah.
You know? But in writing this book, it all sort of came flooding back. And it was a very cathartic,
that's
amazing
really awesome.
Experience to sort of, you know... come to this full circle of like who I am as a person, as a Korean American,
mm-hmm.
as a mother that has biracial children living in sort of, you know, living in sort of two cultures or many, many cultures since we're in New York City. And as a professional chef, you know, having trained in sort of the European techniques. And now, you know, I own this restaurant that is totally traditional, authentic Korean. So there was a lot of lesson learned, and I wanted to sort of put it all down on paper, and it made sense that this cookbook come 2 years, 3 years after INSA. So, and we didn't want to call it INSA cookbook because it's not everything based on that.
Right.
And I want it to be a beautiful cookbook that sort of is a primer for people to understand Korean food and cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have beautiful photos in there taken by my friends Zach and Booge, who also live in Red Hook. And Abrams published it, and they have a superb team. So the design is beautiful. And so I've gotten many great feedbacks about the cookbook.
Yeah.
So that feels good. But it's this whole journey that sort of everything sort of full circle. Always.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is really great. It is really great.
So your next, what are you
going
to do
now? So I'm leading up to this next project. My husband and I, and along with our partner, Sinjin Frizzell, who owns Fort Defiance.
And by the way, I thought you, like 3 years ago, you told me like, I'm not doing this again.
I know. Isn't that awful? I know. We just never learn. But it's exciting. And let me tell you about this. And honestly, 3 years ago, and that was the truth, Jeremy, when I said to you, I'm done. This is it. I'm just going to maintain too much on the plate. But this opportunity came about when Sinjin wanted to open his sophomore project. He has Fort Defiance in Red Hook.
Right.
Very great place. And he is a drink specialist.
And does he live down there too?
Yeah. And in fact, we've been friends for years and years.
Yeah.
He lived in the same house, actually. So he was our our friend that we partied with in Red Hook.
Yeah,
and he also worked at the Good Fork for a little right. bit. Yeah. So he's like family.
Yeah.
And anyway, so he wanted to open a cocktail bar called the Sunken Harbor Club in downtown Brooklyn. And he has been eyeing downtown Brooklyn for like a couple of years now. He's like, there's all these high rises. Yeah. It's changing. There's opportunity there. And you know, he had this whole business, you know, model set up for this amazing cocktail bar that would have, you know, some snacks and food. And he asked me if I would consult on that. And I said, of course. Mm-hmm. And Ben said, you know, I would even help you build it. I think it's going to do really well. So the two boys go out and look at some real estate. And St. John wanted to find sort of an out-of-the-way place, like maybe on the second floor of a building, something a little tucked away, like finding a treasure, right?
Yeah.
Part and parcel of what he wanted to present at the Sunken Harbor Club.
Yeah.
And so they look at this space above some store downtown Brooklyn, and it just is not right. And then the real estate agent says, you know what? I have a beautiful space that I want to show you. And so they walk over, they turn the corner onto Fulton Street, and the cross street, it says Red Hook Lanes, and Ben took notice of that. It's like, oh, the cross street says Red Hook Lanes. That's weird. So the agent opens the door, and they're standing in the middle of Gage and Tolner, which is a historic oyster and chop house that is landmarked. So when you go in there, you see the original gas lamps, the original tapestry, the original woodwork, the gilded mirrors, like the whole thing is there because it was landmarked like 30 years ago or something like that.
And given Ben's taste for
the old things,
all that stuff.
That's right. And yeah, all three of us are like old things. Yeah, this is so cool. And you know, St. John definitely is a history buff. And, you know, we three of us are very much into finding things that are unique and really respecting history. Mm-hmm. That is what lured all of us to Red Hook. And that is what sort of opened our eyes to the possibilities of Gage and Tolner. So the two dudes see this space, they totally get super excited about it. And when I see them next and I say, oh, so how was that space that you saw on the second floor of whatever building? Like, oh, forget that space. You know what we saw? We saw Gage and Tolner. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to reopen Gage and Tolner. And I started laughing. I was like, this is just like sending two little boys out for a quart of milk and they come home dragging a cow. Like, look what I found, ma. But once I saw this space, I just was in love. And we said, this has to come back. Again, it's not about opening an oyster chop house anywhere. It's about this site-specific location that is so steeped in history. Edna Lewis cooked there. She was, you know, the amazing, you know, African-American woman chef. She passed away a long time ago, but she helmed the kitchen, like, in her last days, actually.
Wow.
Dude, just crazy. Since 1879, and it stopped being a restaurant on Valentine's Day 2004. And since then, it's been an Arby's, TGI Friday, clothing store. Nail salon, like you name it. But they're never able to do, whoever comes in as a tenant, they could never change the interior because it is landmarked. So the only logical thing is for somebody to bring this restaurant back to its full glory. And why not three independent Brooklyn restaurateurs that like to think outside of the box?
Can you keep the name?
Well, we're looking into that. Yeah. And it would be great if we could keep the name. And we're hoping that we could keep the name. But if not, you know, we have some other possibilities. Mm-hmm. But it is everybody's. I think a lot of people, I shouldn't say everybody has heard of it, but I think most people, if you talk about Gage and Tolner, they'll say, oh, right, that restaurant.
Yeah.
Especially people of our generation that maybe came to New York in the 90s or late 80s, you know, like you have memories of it. For me, it was the restaurant they had a huge billboard on Flatbush Avenue, oldest restaurant in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Come whatever, check out Gage and Tolner.
That's what I remember.
That's right. And I remember seeing, like, I want to go to that restaurant. And then all of a sudden I read in the newspaper that It's an Arby's. And I'm like, what? How could they take a historic landmark place like that and make it into Arby's? And Arby's only lasted like six, seven months, something like that. And I think people were always sort of afraid of the slow development of downtown Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, it's always about seizing the moment. And three of us feel that it's the right time. So
it does seem to be happening.
Yeah. So we're at the fundraising. We're towards the end of our fundraising time. And a lot of we're selling shares to this company that we want to invite people who want to participate in having this project come back. Financially, we all think that it's going to be, you know, nothing is guaranteed, and restaurants can be tricky.
Right.
They say it's not the best investment, you know, idea, but there is something about this space. There is something about the possibility of bringing Gaze and Toner back. And if we do it right, it could be another success story like the Good Fork or INSA.
I love that when I saw you guys were doing that, I was thinking, you know, it's because of these conversations that you and I have had over the years, I feel like there's something about inviting the community to, like,
that's right,
invest in their own community. Like, totally. Is really what it comes down to.
Totally. And that's one of the reasons why there's the investment raise, the equity raise, you know, the investment funding right now is there are two platforms that we're offering to people. One is obviously equity, where if you want to buy a share of the company, then, you know, this is your company for life.
Yep.
And you will reap the benefits, you know, of how it does. And then the other platform is an online investment platform. Investment. It's not like GoFundMe or Kickstarter. It's not donations.
Yeah.
This is where the platform is smaller. It's bigger, but the amount of potential investment is smaller. So you could small.
What's the minimum?
Minimum is $1,000.
That's so cool.
It's so cool, right? And so we have over 300 people so far that has invested on this platform called wefunder.com/Gaze and Toner. And if you go there, you could see exactly what we're trying to do, our mission statement, your partial business plan, and the exact idea of why and how and who is going to bring this back. And so the idea that 300 people, and we don't even know, like, okay, some are family members, but like only a handful, and the rest is all about people who just know Gaze and Toner. They have, very much like how we were talking about the Good Fork, they have memories of Gaze and Toner. Oh, we got married at City Hall and had the reception at Gaze and Toner back 50 years ago. You know, here's my $1,000. Good luck to you. And so this is an investment platform. Again, crowdsourcing and funding, and then it's about reaching the larger audience, right? Mm-hmm. So it serves us both ways. It raises funds as well as getting the word out that this restaurant needs to come back. So, and if you want to participate, here are ways that you can do it. So,
That's so cool.
It's great, and all the stories that we hear and read on WeFunder, it's just amazing. Like the family members of the original Gaze and Toner. So it's started by two guys, Gaze and Toner, and their descendants, like their great grandchildren, are investing. Yes.
Wow,
and they live
so awesome.
They live not in Brooklyn now, but it's amazing. Like it's just incredible. So it is site specific. It is this opportunity. It's not like three of us are itching to open a oyster chop house anywhere in the city.
Yeah.
It is this or bust.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll button everything up in the next 2 months. We'll sign the lease. We'll get to work, you know, fixing up the interior just a little bit.
Yeah.
With the help of Landmark Commission, and maybe in a year we'll have a restaurant.
That's,
you know,
that's
so that's
great.
That's the project. That's the project that we're working on now, and it's fun. It's super fun. And for me, this idea of bringing back classic dishes and making them really presenting in a way that is a little updated, but they're all they're classics for a reason.
Yeah.
Stuff that people crave.
Yeah.
And they could be as simple as the perfect cream spinach, you know, to go with your mutton chop.
Right.
Or if you don't eat meat, then I want to offer great salads and, you know, still work with lots of vendors and farmers that I have developed a relationship with over the years and just really create another community where you could get great food and great service and create even more memories. So it's kind of romantic, isn't it?
I love it.
Yeah.
So if you weren't a chef and entrepreneur, what else would you be in this life?
Well, you know, when I was little, I always wanted to be a teacher.
Hmm.
And now that there's some sort of recognition in the work that I do volunteer with some organizations and teaching young kids. And so I have a little bit of experience teaching cooking. So that's something that I could do, but it's not necessarily answering your question. What would I be doing if I didn't do this, right? That's the question.
If you weren't cooking, if you were anything else in this life or in your next life, what would
In my next life, I would like to just create art, honestly.
Yeah.
You and I talked about this sort of value of art, and I think, you know, restaurants, to me, it is culinary art, you know, it is consumable art.
Yeah.
It's art that disappears in a nanosecond after, you know, preparing it for hours and hours. That the thought of just creating art, you know, in the medium of paintings or sculpture, that's what I would love to come back as and not have to, not a starving artist. I don't want to be one of those, but I just want to like make beautiful art. And
there's something about what you do already that's kind of in that realm. I mean, you must put dishes together sometimes and just be like,
yeah, sometimes like, I do. Sometimes I do.
Yeah.
But it is this idea of working with my hands that is really appealing. There was a moment where I thought, you know, having a very sort of traditional Korean immigrant upbringing, that I would, you know, ended up at an Ivy League college, and after that you go to law school, and that's when I decided to go to culinary school when I just kept procrastinating. I'd taken the LSATs and I was like, you know, now I have to apply to law school. But is that really what I want to be doing for the rest of my life?
I was a little on the same track. I thought I wanted to go into law. I was an English major.
Right.
I didn't quite know.
Right.
And after college, I just sort of hovered around for a while doing things, and then fell into science and medicine for some reason. I just got totally drawn into all these things. But there's something about the art of healing. That is like also it connects you back to the, you know, our nature and all those things. I could just feel like that was all part of my curiosity. It's like there's a kind of a spiritual quest that's part of that. And it was in the music that I was doing before too. I always felt like that was a connection to it.
That's right.
And so in some ways, you know, I feel like a lot of things for me have come full circle where I'm just incorporating all these pieces together now. And, you know,
totally.
This is my next life, I think.
Totally. Exactly. Why wait for the next life, right?
Right.
And so that's the thing. I don't want to like, you know, like I said, my grandmother was a Buddhist, and there's a lot of Buddhist tenets in philosophy in me.
Yeah.
And I believe in reincarnation and coming back. You know, I often joke that Ben was a like old Korean woman in his former life. That's where we get along so great. But I do believe in it. And so I don't want to wait. But for the most part, we only live this life once. And so I want to be an artist when I grow up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe after restaurants, you know, maybe my days are sort of numbered in it. You know, it is a stressful job. And sometimes I do think about pursuing other things. And I don't think you're ever too old to pursue anything that you truly want to pursue.
Right.
I
think you already are an artist.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's a lot of art form aspects of what we do that I do appreciate and recognize. But I don't know, like that brooding artist in the studio, like covered in paint and like, I don't know, just expressing emotion, you know, onto a canvas.
I've seen you in the kitchen before. There's some brooding going on.
I think it's a solo work.
Splatters of different things.
Yeah. Well, after all this talk about community building and, you know, being so special to be a part of that, sometimes I do long for a quiet time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the allure of like my idea of what an artist's life is.
Yeah.
It's like spending that sort of quality time alone. And that would be a good retirement, actually.
Yeah.
You know, if we ever get there.
Yeah.
projects.
You're the best, Zoe. I'm so thanks for doing this with me.
Are you kidding me? This is super fun. This is super fun.
And your newest cookbook is called
Korean Home Cooking.
Korean Home Cooking.
Yeah, published by Abrams, and hopefully it's in all the bookstores. It's available online.
Online.
But you know, talking about community, I like when people go out and support their local bookstores.
I saw there's a new bookstore up on Smith Street.
Yeah, I gave a little talk and a signing there. Books of Magic, it's called. So if you're in these parts of Brooklyn, then Books of Magic on Smith, they definitely carry it.
All right, everybody, go check out the cookbook. And the Good Fork cookbook is also out there.
Yeah, it's out there. And the Good Fork restaurant and INSA. Yeah, and look out for Gage and Tolner.
All right.
A little bit.
Awesome. All right, thanks so much.
It's super fun. Thanks, Jeremy.
Sohee Kim, folks. Always so much fun to talk to her. Amazing to hear her story. And so many things I knew, but so many things I didn't know. The one thing that came to me from listening back to this conversation is the importance of art. Art is a big part of our world. It creates the fabric that is our world. And to appreciate it is to live more fully. In Zoe's case, the art disappears into the mouth of its intended audience, and they are left with its effects and its experience. People like Zoe and Ben improve our communities by dedicating their artistry to them and by taking care of its people. As Zoe's Hurricane Sandy tale proves, businesses need patrons, but the community needs them just as much. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Let me know your thoughts on this topic and conversation. You can always email me at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.